baseball season is over. And so now baseball teams are looking to getting other players because some players leave and they have to replace those players. So let's say the Astros decide they need to replace a player and they want him to be a good player and want him to be very adept at batting, for example. So they find out there's a player available by the name of Casey. And so they send a bus to get Casey. And so, sure enough, one morning, here comes the bus, and right on the side of that bus is the name Casey. So they're anxiously anticipating this new player to replace the ones that have left. And the first guy that gets off, he's kind of humped over, and he's got a cane. He can barely move. And they say, "Who are you?" He said, "I'm Casey." Well, they're a little disappointed about that. And then the next person that comes off kind of got a high voice. Has long hair, wearing a dress. So who are you? "I'm Casey." We got a problem. Third person gets off. They're holding a little baby. It's kind of crying. "What's your baby's name?" "Casey." But finally, the guy steps down. He weighs about 200 pounds. Fitness of health. In fact, he's got a bat in his hand. "Who are you?" "I'm Casey." You can see that the bus, Casey, has a number of passengers. And if the wrong passenger gets off to answer the need of the moment, you've got confusion. You do not reach your goal. Well, that's a simple illustration of how words are used. Words are like the vehicle, the bus. But words have different meanings, that is, different passengers. So when you want to send a thought, a bus word is a vehicle to convey your thought. The problem is that bus has different passengers, so you put whatever passenger meaning that you meant on the bus. But when it gets to the person who hears you or reads what you wrote, if the wrong passenger gets off, what you intended is not realized. There's confusion. There's mistakes made. And that's the same thing with studying the Bible. We have on your lesson Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 4. We're familiar with this text where Paul said, "When you read what I wrote," when you read, I wrote this before in brief, "when you read, you can understand my insight into the mystery of Christ." Well, that assumes that we respect the laws of human language. What that says is that God chose the medium of human language to convey his will to us. Therefore, the laws that govern human language, such things as nouns and adjectives and verbs, etc., and how they're used, and the meanings of the words we use, must be understood and applied for us to understand the divine will. That's just the very nature of the case. You could call that axiomatic. You don't have to prove that. That's just the nature of the case. So we've given an illustration this morning, and hope you see that. And in the course of our study, we'll see that the failure sometimes to get the right passenger off the bus can lead to confusion. So we'll be looking at some passages that hopefully illustrate that. You know, we have some great deacons here in the congregation, and they They're dedicated to their work. They're attentive to what needs to be done. And it's a real pleasure to work with these men. One of those deacons is Craig Otterback. Craig takes care of the bulletin. You know, I didn't send out this lesson until yesterday. And Craig went and did his research and put these articles in the bulletin. You probably haven't had a chance to read it yet. But he got these off of some Facebook posts that I posted back in 17. And they're so fitting for what we're doing today. Now, the ones that he put in the paper are not the ones we're talking about today, but if we have time at the end of our class, we can look at some of these. But I encourage you to look at these. The ones that I wrote about back then are vivid illustrations of misconceptions that are drawn because when people see a word, they have a wrong idea of what is being intended by the speaker or writer, that is, in the New Testament. So anyway, I appreciate Craig doing that. I encourage you to read the article, and it can be an addenda to what we're doing today. Psalm 119, 130. We'll start there. I put this verse because it's such a great introduction to what we're doing today, because the writer says, the unfolding of your words gives light. Some birds say the entrance of your words gives light. Note it says it gives understanding to the simple. The word simple is a bus that has different passengers. One of the meanings of the word simple, you can go check this out if you wish in your own dictionary. You can do a search on the web in a web dictionary. And you'll see that one of the definitions of simple is lacking intelligence, low intelligence. So he's a simple-minded man. He's not able to think in complex ways or do things that involve maybe strategy or that kind of thing. He can do very simple things, but he's very limited in his mental faculties. And that's one way the word is used. But that is not what is meant here. The word simple here is lacking in knowledge or understanding. So it gives understanding. That's what this simple person needs, understanding. Not a higher mental faculty, but understanding, gives understanding to the simple. Sometimes it's helpful to compare versions, and we've talked about that. One of the ones that's sometimes useful is called the New English Translation. It's often has some very helpful notes with it. And in its translation of this particular text, it says they give insight to the untrained. That's a good way to put it. But let's look at some verses together. Look at Proverbs chapter 1, verse 4. One way to see how words are used is to compare their usages in other places in the version that you're reading. In Proverbs chapter 1, verse 4, where does the word simple occur in that verse? Right, naive. Look at the footnote. See the little footnote? If you have a footnote, if you're reading the New American Standard, there's a little footnote there. And you'll see out in the footnote, it says simple, literally, simple ones. So what have the translators done? Interpreted. Correct interpretation. Naive, that other version, remember I said put untrained. People who are lacking, not in. They maybe have a high IQ, but lacking in practical wisdom and understanding. And he applies that to young people as well as older people in this introduction in the first seven verses. So all can benefit. So to give prudence to the naive, those untrained, and those who have more understanding can also benefit, as he goes on to point out. To the youth, youth is parallel with naive. Youth has had the years of experience to gain that understanding. You know, we look back at our lives and we say, man, I wish I'd have known that 20 years ago. When you get your children raised, you say, man, I wish I'd have known when I had the children what I know now. But here's a book that can provide us with that wisdom and understanding from the get-go, to provide understanding to the simple or the naive. In chapter 7, verse 7, here's the picture of a young man that's being seduced by a woman. He just doesn't use good sense. It says, at the window of my house, I looked out through my lattice, and I saw among the naive. Again, you'll note in the margin, the simple ones. It's not that he's dumb. He's just not thinking about this woman and her, the danger that she presents. And so what he does, he's a young man lacking sense. Note we said it's not lacking ability, but lacking sense, common sense, as it were. And so what he does, he goes by her house, and she takes that opportunity to seduce him, and that's the story. And so when we read these verses about simple, you can see by, like in the proverb, you know, we have parallelism, where you have one line, another line parallel, and sometimes it's synonymous in meaning, different words mean the same thing, sometimes it's opposite in meaning. And that will clue us in to how the word is being used. For example, look at chapter 22 and verse 3. The prudent sees the evil and hides himself, but the naive, or simple, go in and are punished for it. Now this time it's antithetic parallelism. That is, the first line states one side of the issue, the second line states the opposite. So what's the opposite of naive in this text? Prudent, right? Prudent. So you can see what is meant by simple. And there's a number of other passages. We'll not go into all of those. But you can see, and you can go through Proverbs and find a number of these examples, either by doing a search on the word naive, or if you have King James Version on your digital device, switching to the King James Version and do a search for the word simple, and you'll find a number of those illustrations. But you can see how Psalm 119:30 would be misinterpreted if the wrong passenger gets off the bus. And people who ridicule the Bible, they take it that way. Say, oh yeah, the Bible for people who are kind of dumb anyway, gives understanding to the simple. Smart people don't read the Bible. And that would be obviously a travesty as to how to use the Word of God and show ignorance, all right, but it's the ignorance on the person, on the part of the person who makes that kind of a application. Any comments before we go to our next verse? Good. That's right. Good observation. All right, look at Genesis 1:28. Did you know that the Bible teaches that there was a race of men that filled the earth before Adam? Do you know that there are people who teach that?
We're all apostles.
What?
We're all apostles, Caleb, brother.
Well, they don't have any, but yes, but that's, there are people who teach there was a race of men that filled the earth before Adam. And one of the verses we'll be using is this one. Now, you'll note I put on here KJV, and ASV. What was the KJV, the King James translated originally? 1611. The version people read now, do you know what date it is? 1779. There were several different revisions, but I think the latest one, something of that nature. The American Standard Version, when was it translated? Do you know? 1901. So over 100 years ago. So remember when you use versions, that they were translating them not for 2019 or 2020 like on this lesson, but they were translating them for the way the words were used at the time those translations were made. And so in the King James, in the American Standard Version, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. What does replenish suggest to you? What? Replace? Okay. It suggests the idea of doing it again, doesn't it? It did not mean that when the King James Version was translated. That is a meaning of replenish. But you can go do your own research on this if you wish. In the LEXICO dictionary on the web, it's sponsored by Oxford Dictionary, one of the definitions is late Middle English to supply abundantly. Now put that definition in here. Go and supply abundantly the earth. There's no again to it. That's why these other versions have replaced the word replenish with fill the earth. Here's a quote from a man by the name of William Wordsworth. He lived from 1770 to 1850. Got on my notes, 1170 to 1850. I want to see what kind of vitamins he used. But anyway, 1770 to 1850. Here's something he wrote. His hive has been long replenished with honey. That is full of, abundant. His hive is full of honey. Shakespeare, we've all heard Shakespeare, lived 1564 to 1616. Here's a quote from one of his writings, the most replenished villain in the world. That is, abundantly supplied villain in the world. And so when we read Genesis 1, and so you may be talking to somebody and they may make this kind of an argument and say, the world was repopulated by Adam because the Bible says he was to replenish the earth. So if you're familiar with this simple concept that we're talking about today and compare versions, you can see there's no substance to that argument. Any questions or comments on that? Okay, let's go to 1 Peter 3:1. By the way, what we're doing should be an alert to those who may study with somebody who's using the King James Version. I'm not saying they can't use it. It was a good version, very helpful for hundreds of years, and it's still a good version. It's just archaic in some of its language. It also should be alert to parents if their children read the King James Version, because they're going to run across these kind of words. And what's going to happen is the wrong passenger is going to get off the bus. And so in your effort to train your children, we've got parents here dedicated to that. Keep this in mind. 1 Peter 3:1, there's hardly anybody in here that uses the King James Version. I know one person. And I don't know if anybody else besides Sally uses it, but of course it's just an alternative for her. She's got several versions on her tablet. But in this verse 1, it talks about a woman winning her husband. It says that they may be won by the conversation of their wives. Now today, conversation means what? Speech, talking. It's how we convey thoughts, is through speech, through words. If we attach that meaning to the word conversation, what problem arises in this verse? She's to be won. What does the text say? What? Without a word. By the words? Without a word? By our conversation? That doesn't make sense, does it? That's contradictory. That doesn't make any sense. She's to be won without a word. And then he says, by her words. And you see how that would be confusing. You know, this ball team said, I paid $1 million for this new player, and he can't hardly walk. He's on a cane. Something's wrong. Same thing here. You read this, say, there's something wrong here. Well, of course, you see in the version you're probably reading, it'll either say conduct. I think the New King James says conduct. The New American Standard says behavior. Now, that makes sense in the text. You wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, that is, the word of the gospel, they may be won without a word. Nobody's won without the gospel. The seed has to be sown in the heart and to produce the fruit. So a word is not the gospel word, but a word from the wife, that is, by her continual pressing him, nagging him, as it were, that's not going to win him to Christ. What will maybe influence your behavior, your conduct, as he beholds, as he observes, your chaste and respectful behavior. So he sees the way you live. What's making my wife be devoted to me? Maybe his conscience will be awakened. I haven't been the greatest guy, but she continues to love me, honor me, to cooperate with me. What's driving her to faith? And there have been cases like that. So anyway, here's a case where you end up in absolute confusion if you don't understand which passenger is on the bus. Look at 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 15. In the New American Standard, it says, like the Holy One who called you, be holy yourselves in all your behavior. In the King James Version, it's in all your conversation. Now, it is true that we are to be holy in our speech, in our words. No question about that. That's a true statement. But the problem is, it's much more that's in view here. It's not just the words you speak. Clean up your language. It's clean up your life. It's your behavior every day. And you know that as you read the book. He talks about, throughout 1 Peter, how you conduct yourself toward government, how you conduct yourself toward your employer, how you conduct yourself to your mate, how you conduct yourself to your neighbor, how you conduct yourself to your brethren. All the way through the book, he discusses that very thing. So be holy in all your conduct, all your behavior. So this would be a case where the conclusion may not be in error, but it really doesn't grasp what the writer intended. Okay? You know, that bus that has Casey on it, there may be a 15-year-old boy that gets off. He looks pretty good, but it's not what you paid $1 million for. He doesn't feel what you were looking for when you asked for Casey. And the same thing is true here. We will not feel what the writer had in mind or the Holy Spirit had in mind as he guided the pen of Peter. Any questions, comments about that one?
Steve?
Yes?
You mentioned about the origin of the word. It's interesting on this word, conversation, is from the Middle English, 1100 to 1450, and actually meant living among. So it actually fits back in those days, they understood what conversation.
Yeah, evidently it had that, even that far back, some of that connotation, didn't it? I've got one quote here from 1749. The landlady would by no means have admitted any conversation of disreputable kind to pass under her roof. That's a writer by the name of Henry Fielding. Don't know anything about it. But it's showing in 1749 that we're using the word conversation to mean conduct. No disreputable, not speech. She wouldn't allow that either, but that's not what was in mind. Conduct. That's an actual quote from somebody who lived and wrote in that particular era. So, as Rocky pointed out way back, this word was used that way. All right, Judges chapter 2, 16. Now, before we look at this verse, when you're just talking with someone and you mention a judge, what image comes to their mind? A court. Somebody in a court, maybe with a robe on, behind a large bench or something, who makes decisions about people, right and wrong, that kind of thing. Look over at Deuteronomy 16. Look at verse 18. You shall appoint for yourself judges and officers in all your towns. Notice the last phrase in the verse. They shall judge the people with righteous judgment. You shall not distort justice, etc. In chapter 17, verse 8, if any case is too difficult for you to decide between one kind of homicide or another, between one kind of lawsuit or another, between one kind of assault or another, being cases of dispute in your court, then you shall arise and go up to the place which the Lord your God chooses, and you shall come to the Levitical priest or the judge, who is an office in those days. You shall inquire of them, and they shall declare to you the verdict in the case. That's maybe not exactly what we think about in a judge today, because we think of a legal courtroom, but it's the idea of those who would render a verdict in a dispute between people. And the encouragement is to render just judgment. So the word was used that way. But now look at Judges chapter 2, verse 16. Then the Lord raised up judges. Is that judges like we just read about in Deuteronomy?
No.
So what is the connotation? What's the passenger on the bus here?
Military
leader. Deliverers. Look at the rest of the verse. That's good. The judges who delivered them from the hands of those who plundered them. Look down at verse 18. The Lord raised up judges for them. The Lord was with the judge and delivered them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. So he's a deliverer, as Linda put it very well, a military commander of some sort to deliver the people from oppression. Well, even in the Bible, then, you may see this word judge, and it has these two legitimate passengers. Both have a ticket punch to ride the bus called judge. How do you determine which passenger gets off in Judges versus gets off at Deuteronomy?
Context.
That's how you do it. And so There's the value of always looking for meanings of words defined contextually by the words and phrases around them. And to further confirm in Judges that you're on the right track, you can read the rest of the book and see actually these judges and what they did. That's not to say that at times judges didn't render verdicts in civil matters. Look at chapter 4 and verse 4. Here's Deborah, a judge, a prophetess. She was judging Israel at that time. She used to sit under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim, and the sons of Israel came up to her for judgment, not for deliverance from their enemies. Here it is in the sense of rendering some kind of fair judgment in cases that needed to be decided. But what she's known for is encouraging Barak. She says, I was a mother in Israel, like a mother would encourage her son to grow up and be a man and take responsibility. And so Deborah encouraged Barak to do what he needed to do, and he took the leadership of the army and led the people to victory. And so that's what she's known for in the book of Judges particularly. Although she didn't lead the army, she was the one that occasioned their deliverance through her attitude and conduct. And there's other cases, 1 Samuel, etc., where judges rendered decisions. So in every case, here we are, Deborah, a judge, we say deliver. But in this particular context, he's talking about her work in rendering decisions for judgment between people. On which?
Judges 2:17.
Okay.
It talks about the people, you know, yes, in 16 it talks about judges to deliver from the hands of their enemies. And then it talks about the people not listening to their judges, and then they go after other gods.
So what were the judges telling them to do?
To serve God.
Serve God. Judges were the ones who believed in God and thus delivered them. Not listening to the judges is not the idea of, oh, here was a civil judgment that was rendered and I'm not going to abide by that. It's not a civil type thing between two people. It's that the judges are trying to lead them to away from idolatry. So that's a good point. They did not listen to their judges. Once again, contextually, he tells you what he means. For they played the harlot after other gods, which tells you listening to their judges would have sent them down a different path. That is a path of obedience to the one true living God. Good observation. Okay. All right. Now, when you prayed this morning or last night, did you go in where you hang your clothes? Get in the closet and pray. That's what Jesus said to do. Look at Matthew 6:6. In the King James Version, that is. When you pray, go into your closet. Some of you may have a hard time getting in your closet and finding a place to pray. Go to your closet. That's the way we use the word today. It's not limited to that meaning even today, as I found out by looking up definitions. But that is usually the idea that it's used. So once again, it'd be a good passage to sit down and talk with your children, or if you're teaching a class with young children, to make them aware of this, or if you're studying with somebody that uses the King James Version, to make them aware of these kind of things so they're not misled. So you'll note this version translates, go into your inner room. And so the word closet, late Middle English, Rocky mentioned that a while ago, in late Middle English, was denoting a private or a small room. So it could be like your bedroom. Go go into your bedroom. This bird says inner chamber. Sometimes bedrooms were called chambers. So it'd be like saying, instead of just standing out where everybody can see you for public display so they'll know how righteous you are, and that's what he's dealing with, hypocrisy. Go to some private place. Doesn't even have to be a room. It's the idea that you're not praying to be seen of men. As you look down up in verse 2, so that they may be honored by men. Yes, Alex? Okay, that's a closet. Alex talked about praying while he's driving his vehicle. So that becomes his closet, his private area.
Sir?
Secret area, that's right. Your Father who sees in secret will reward you, verse 4. So that's the idea. All right, 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 1. If you talk about, if somebody says, or you're describing somebody, say they are a person who really practices charity, what meaning is conveyed to the person who's listening to you?
Give
a lot away, acts of alms, benevolence, they're considerate of people in need. That's the way we use the word charity. The King James Version, instead of the word love, throughout this chapter, uses the word charity. Now, the love that he's describing encompasses charity. That's true. That was our meaning of charity. But that in no way grasps the fullness of the word that's being used. How can you know which is in view? Charity in the sense of almsgiving and benevolence, or in some other sense? How can you know which one it is? Context again. You start in verse 4. Love is patient. Love is kind. How do you respond to being hurt, being injured, for example? Is not jealous, does not brag, is not arrogant. Josh just taught some excellent classes on verse 5. It does not seek its own. That's what love does. And so, all through verse 4 through 7, he describes some characteristics of an attitude that is selfless and seeks the good or the welfare of the person loved. That's the nature of love. It's not emotional. In fact, it may be just against emotions, because if somebody hurts you, how do you feel emotionally? You want to respond in kind. You want to hurt them. Or have nothing to do with them at all. But love is patient. Love is kind. So it's an attitude that must rise above, in fact, our emotions. All right, so we're thankful that the translators of our versions have conveyed the meaning in words that fit our language. Romans 1:29. You believe it's okay to debate?
Yes.
Sally, you got your King James handy?
Yes, sir.
Okay, now, these are people who don't acknowledge God, verse 28. Read verse 29 about some of the things they do.
Being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate, deceit,
malignity, whisperers. Full of envy, murder, debate. See, all you people who are members of the Church of Christ, y'all want to debate all the time. The Bible condemns it. Right there in Romans 1:29. Well, of course, the word debate, our version says strife. King James, New King James, New American Standard, ASV says strife. But in the online etymological dictionary, etymology, as you know, is the origin of a word. dictionaries that trace origins. It says that late 14th century, to quarrel or dispute, to combat, fight, or make a war. In a quote from, how do you pronounce, Chaucer? Is that the way you pronounce it? Canterbury Tales, is that the way you pronounce it? Chaucer. 1343 to 1400. Here's a quote. Tale both of peace and of debates. So what is debates put in contrast with there? Peace. See, peace versus debate, strife, or war, right? That idea. So that's what's being condemned here, is the stirring up of bitterness, anger, strife, that kind of thing. Not a reasonable discussion of differences, presenting arguments in favor of what you believe. You read the book of John, it's a record of Jesus' debates. Over again, he was debating. Book of John. Paul had a custom to go into the city and debate the Jews in their synagogue. Acts 15, he got in a big debate with those who were trying to encourage circumcision as a requisite to be saved for the Gentiles. So this verse does not condemn what we practice today, known as debating. Well, my time is up, so we're not going to get to the rest of these. You can look at them if you wish. 2 Corinthians 6:12, bowels. I don't think I have on your class copy Genesis 1:29, meat. How we use the word meat different from the way it was used when King James was translated, although it is still a legitimate translation, meaning to say food. We usually think of meat as animal flesh that we eat. But there it was plants, for example. That could be very helpful when we study the sacrifices. Because they're talking about offering meat, but it's not talking about animal flesh at all. Okay, so if you wish to study this any further, I appreciate Craig putting this in the bulletin. These are some practical applications where, like on the word baptize, the word works, the phrase Church of Christ, where people draw wrong conclusions because the wrong pastor gets off the bus. Thank you for your attention this morning.